Azalyn and Liza didn't have to brave the cold to see Saturn. They could see it from the window of their bedroom, which was on the east wall of Castle Eyrie overlooking the sea. For this very reason, the room had a window seat, a padded leather bench built into the sill of the big main window, and that's just where the two girls were sitting, bundled up in Liza's cloak and looking up at the golden gas giant. "Seems like it's going really well so far," said Azalyn, a little drowsily. She reached up with a lazy gesture and brushed some of Liza's slightly damp blonde curls away from her warm, flushed face. "So far," Liza agreed, closing her hand around the one Azalyn had outstretched, then kissing the Dantrovian's knuckles. "Tomorrow will be the real test, though. There'll be a lot more people around who I've given reason to make me unwelcome in the past."
"Yeah, but none of them are the host," Azalyn pointed out.
"And he seems to like the new you,"
she added through a prodigious yawn.
Well, bang goes that old myth," she mused.
Liza cocked a pale eyebrow.
"Oh," said Azalyn with a drowsy smile. "It's a commonly held misconception among humans that Dantrovians are insatiable. For the record," she yawned again, then added in a thicker voice,
"for the record, it's not true."
Liza smiled, then gathered Azalyn up and got to her feet.
"Well, then I guess I'd better put you to bed," she said.
It was half bravado, of course, as she herself was also very tired, but it was too classy a gesture to pass up. She got them both arranged under the covers, tossed her cloak across the room to fall hanging on one of the hooks near the door, then reached up and extinguished the lone hollow torch that had been left lighting the place when they'd arrived from the library 2 hours before.
"Good night, Azalyn," she murmured, kissing the Dantrovian's forehead. "Do you suppose Santa will bring us anything nice in the morning?"
"Doubt it," Azalyn mumbled sleepily. "We've been awfully naughty."
Liza chuckled, burrowed down just a little deeper in the covers, and drifted off to sleep. Utina came strolling around the corner from the east tower, Gnoll on her shoulder, hands in her pockets, whistling the carol of the bells, just in time to see Jury kissing Kate goodnight in the doorway to Kate's room. There was a time when to be spotted doing something of the sort would have been a matter of great embarrassment for Jury, earning the spotter a cold shoulder, or worse, if she were foolish enough to make some overt acknowledgement of what she'd witnessed. Today, though, Utina's knowing little smirk just got returned in kind, as Jury passed by her in the hall with a nod and a quiet, "Good night, Tenjo."
"You know," said Utina with cheery thoughtfulness as she elbowed the door shut behind her and hung up her coat, "I think you're good for her."
Kate went a little pink and replied,
"Well, I hope so. I mean, I hope I wasn't bad for her."
"No, I mean it," said Utina. She sat down, took off her shoes, and went on, "I mean, some of it can be put down to just getting out from under that damn tournament. That's helped all of us. But I think you're, I don't know, teaching her that it's okay to smile. She's taking herself less seriously."
"Which is good," Gnoll observed, "because if she'd taken herself any more seriously, she'd have snapped by now."
Leaving Gnoll on the bed, Utina went into the bathroom, brushed her teeth, changed into her pajamas. Then she came out and sprawled back on her side of the bed while Kate took her turn.
"You're looking a bit more chipper this year than last yourself," Gnoll observed as Kate emerged. "I think maybe the redhead agrees with you, too."
"Hush, Gnoll," said Kate with a modest little gesture. Gnoll performed a little ducking maneuver that, for him, was like a shrug. "Hey, I call him like I see him."
"Shouldn't you be getting off to your pile of gold, dragon?" asked Uchenna with a grin as she punched up her pillow and got under the covers.
I could, Nal replied, but I'd much rather while away this Christmas Eve in your sweet arms, my treasure, he added with a rather cheesy grin.
Uchenna tried to give him a stern look, failed utterly, and then, laughing, said, Who am I to resist a line like that? She raised the corner of the coverlet, and Nal, grinning wider still, scampered in and arranged himself. Kate chuckled, climbed in on her own side with the rather more passive Seven, and switched off the lights.
Good night, Kate, said Uchenna softly.
Night, Uchenna, she replied, adding, Nal.
Mumbled Nal, already half asleep. Well, said Griffin as he settled himself down in the master bedroom up in the North Tower, I think this is going pretty well.
Kay replied sleepily. I wonder how many of the kids will be able to get up in the morning after your little do what thou wilt speech, she added with a chuckle.
Oh, I don't know, said Griffin, smiling. I expect they'll all turn up for breakfast.
Not so sure, Kay mused. I remember being that age, even if I never actually was. Somebody told me what you told them this afternoon. I wouldn't come out for days.
Griffin chuckled. Wild child, were you?
Oh, yeah, Kay asserted, stretching lazily. Blonde streak bleached in my hair, devil green contact lenses, 100 pounds of hell looking for a place to break loose. Pris is going to be just like me in a couple years. Start dreading it now.
Griffin made a face. I started last year, he informed her wryly. That's why I shocked poor Mrs. Savage by sending them into biocontrol so early. I'm thinking it's time for Guy to get his own room.
I'm thinking the twins will assassinate us if we try it, Kay replied.
There is that, conceded her husband. Though I expect he'll be asking for one pretty soon on his own.
Well, we can burn that bridge when we get to it.
I suppose. There was a pause. Green contact lenses?
Yep. I thought green eyes were sexier than boring old brown.
Well, what a shame, then. By the time I met you, you were already a staid, mature, responsible, boring 19-year-old.
Kay nodded sadly. Yep, and now we're old, decrepit parents, she said, inflecting parents in that teenage way that means older than the freaking Hittites.
Griffin sighed, feeling the weight of years pressing down on his frail old bones. Patted her hand and replied in a wistful tone,
Yep.
Silence.
So, said Kay. You wanna?
Oh, yeah.
To his eternal chagrin, the Lord of the Manor and his lady were the last ones of all to the breakfast table on Christmas morning. And the look in his eldest daughter's smiling eyes as he passed her at the head of the table let him know that she knew precisely why. It made him feel very, very weird, but at least Kate didn't wink at him. That would have been a little too much to bear on a Sunday morning. He sat down, yawned, wished everyone a good morning, and unfurled his festive holly-edged napkin from its candy cane napkin holder. The exquisite care with which the table had been set for Christmas breakfast informed him without having to ask of the answer to his next question, so he didn't bother asking it. Instead, a moment later, Beldandi Morisato bustled out of the kitchen with a large platter of pancakes.
"Good morning," she said brightly, putting the platter down in the middle of the table. "I trust everyone had a good night?"
Griffin coughed, almost spraying Erd, seated opposite him, with English breakfast tea. The elder Norn didn't help matters any by reaching across under the table and playfully caressing his calf with one bare foot.
"Spectacular," Kay assured Bell, who took it in the spirit in which it was meant,
said she was glad, assured them that bacon and hash browns would be right out, and vanished back into the kitchen.
"You know," Griffin observed as he recovered his composure, "one of these days I'm going to have Belle for a guest at something and not end up having her cook everything."
Kate grinned. "Oh, she's not cooking everything.
"Oh? Who else?"
"I believe," said Jury dryly, "Iron Chef Tenjo is assisting."
"Hmm," said Sionji, nodding. "This is definitely her toast." Wakaba gave him a funny look.
"You can identify people's cooking from the way they do toast?"
Sionji shrugged. "It's a gift," he replied.
"God, you're weird," said Wakaba.
"I thought that was why you liked me," he protested. "Only at the time you pronounced it exotic," he added with a little grin.
Wakaba smirked. "I didn't say it was a bad thing."
A moment later, Belle returned with a tray of bacon and hash browns. Utena, bearing sausage links and a syrup assortment, was right behind her.
"There," said Belle. "That's all taken care of. Thank you for your help, Utena dear."
Utena grinned, taking her seat between Kate and Corwin.
"Happy to help, especially since you were pressed for time."
"Hmm, and speaking of, I'd best get back. I'll see you all at lunchtime," said the Norn, and she disappeared back into the kitchen.
"There's a mirror in the kitchen?" asked Wakaba.
"For just that purpose," Utena replied. "Well, go on, grab a pancake. Plenty for everybody."
"Oh my," said Beldandy, emerging from the kitchen again. "I must be in a hurry. I'm forgetting things."
She put a large plate down in front of Moose McEachern. On that plate was an even larger omelette.
"There you are, Mr. McEachern, just the way you like it," she added with a theatrical little flourish.
Moose's pleasantly unhandsome face split in a huge grin.
"Gosh, thanks, Mrs. M," he said, then took a deep sniff and grinned even wider. "Genuine wiffle fruit and everything."
Belle smiled. "Only the best on Christmas morning," she replied. "Oh dear, now I really must go," she added, then said another round of goodbyes, interrupted by the mock-irritated shooing motions of her elder sister, and fled once more. From the dining room they went to the library, where the number of stockings nailed up along the mantelpiece almost gave the room the look of a stocking factory for a moment. As the previous year, everybody in attendance got one, and all of them had a mix of standard items, orange in the toe, jar of dry roast cashews, and personalized ones, guitar strings for Mickey, super heavy-duty picks for Moose, flechette blocks for Sylvie. Everybody got a crystal copy of the Art of Noise live album recorded in Toronto back in March, which Mickey and Liza had finished mixing down and mastering during her training period on the band's sound gear. Liza was startled, surprised, and really quite touched to find that there was a stocking there with her name on it. She hadn't been expecting one. Just being tolerated between these walls was enough for her. But Kate's mother, bustling around relishing her hostess role, was quite insistent, and so Liza had a stocking. With her lip trembling, she delved into it and found a whetstone, 10 lint and sprungly amaretto Linder truffles, the aforementioned music crystal, a pack of bright purple pens, which nicely matched the silk swashbuckler shirt she'd been wearing the day she reappeared at Mandeville Memorial, perfect for signing her new name with a great flourish on documents of varying importance. 10 blackberry-scented votive candles, the aforementioned jar of dry roast cashews, and, stuffed way down into the toe to give the stocking body, a chunk of anthracite about the size of her fist. Upon dragging this prize out, thinking it was awfully hard and lumpy to be an orange, Liza stared at it for a few moments, her lovely blue eyes going wide, and for just a second Griffin worried that he'd gone too far with the joke and upset her. Then she turned to Azalin, and they both burst out laughing. Relieved, Griffin grinned.
A fat man in red told me that's for the last of your karmic debt, he told her, pointing at the coal. Liza wiped the tears of mirth from her face, put the lump of coal down on top of the cashew jar, and told him with twinkling eyes, I'll treasure it always.
All right, said Belana Torres excitedly. Check it out, Mia. A Toynbee coil calibrator. Awesome!
That's lovely, replied Mia Ausa, who had no idea what a Toynbee coil was, nor why Belana should care to calibrate one. Once they finished with their stockings, it was time for the tree, and with the lighting in the room lowered and the tree's lights turned up, the library became even cozier, lending to the overall feeling of warmth and family that permeated the occasion.
Boy, said Wakaba, voicing the sentiment that all of them were feeling, this is cozy, a duelist family Christmas.
Utina snickered and looped an arm around her old friend, threatening to muss up her onion-like hairstyle. This elicited an indignant demand from Wakaba for Sionji to defend her honor. The green-haired duelist informed her that, it being Christmas, he was off duty, and that, as far as he knew, he was the only current threat to her honor anyway, so he wasn't the best source to seek aid from in that matter in the first place. They dove in without the orderly procession that had characterized Christmas Eve. By Hutchins-Morgan family policy, the tree sort and unwrap was a free-for-all of tag-reading, package-passing, and paper-shredding. Everybody had presents. That was also a family policy. As before, as always, there were a lot of books. Data crystals of music were also popular. Also clothes, which were not, in this family, met with the stereotypical dread. There were also a few special things. Tiny Robo and Lesser Mazinger got certificates entitling them to a performance upgrade in Corwin's New Avalon lab as soon as the festivities relocated to that city later in the week. Utina had a large box from Kate which turned out to contain, to her delighted surprise, or perhaps surprise delight, a nicely compact 10-inch catadioptric telescope and some accessories for same. Miki, inspired by Dorothy's birthday gift for Caitlin last time around, gave Dorothy an elegantly beautiful pocket watch with a replica of the Turing Institute's sentient certification medal built into the back of the case. Technically, Dorothy didn't need a watch, but the delight on her face showed that she appreciated the sentiment all the same. There were a few more tongue-in-cheek gifts, too, like the little tuxedo jacket for Nall. Oh, cool! Now I can look sharp at Rocket Boy's wedding in about 100 years. A book from Jury to Kate about improving one's bowling game, and of course Pris Morgan tried to give her twin brother Guy to Sylvie Daniels, much to Guy's dismay. Miki Kaworu also received a timepiece, a very elegant and stylish wristwatch which was cunningly constructed to tell the time on a planet called Bariar, a world whose solar day was something along the lines of 26.5 hours long. There were also a couple of gifts that didn't make much sense, at least at face value. Another of Utina's gifts was an isolinear memory key rod, without any explanation enclosed of what it was for. Corwin and his father, whose names were on the tag, just smiled and told her, "When we get to New Avalon, you'll find out." At just around the time the mess of paper and foil was taken care of, Megazone sloped in, unheralded and unannounced, with his arms full of boxes. Some people seemed a little startled, since he'd just wandered in from the kitchen, an area that didn't have access from outside, but Utina was used to it and just gave him a welcoming grin. "Sorry I'm late," said the burdened Chaos Walker. "You should have seen the traffic." As he passed the packages around, the bell on the extremely incongruous Santa hat he wore jingling merrily, the stack he carried seemed not to get any smaller for a while, until at last he was left with only one box, which seemed to be about the same size as the whole pile he'd entered with. It was silver and not wrapped, just tied across the top with a large red bow. This the big man set down carefully, almost gingerly, in front of Caitlin. "Kate," he said, "this is for me, your parents, Aunt Erd, Jury, and Bernie Kaltingen." Kate looked puzzled for a moment. "Bernie Kaltingen?" Then blinked,
then blinked again. Then, slowly, almost dreamily, she reached forward, pulled one of the streamers to undo the bow, and removed the lid from the box. Her face, halfway between confused and trepid, melted into complete astonishment, then blazed into pure glowing joy. "Oh," she said, the sound almost unvocalized. Slowly, carefully, she leaned forward, reached into the box, and removed its contents. For a second, Utina thought it was another stuffed tiger. Caitlin had over 100 of them, and it had seemed a little odd to her roommate that she hadn't received any for this Christmas. This one made up for it, though. It was quite large, about the size of a middle-sized dog, and very well detailed. It had a rich, silky orange coat, bushy white sideburns, the brightest amber eyes Utina had ever seen in a stuffed animal, which blinked, and its tail, hanging lazily over Kate's cradling arms, just moved. "Holy cow," said Corwin reverently. That's a real tiger," Utina murmured, as if trying to explain it to herself. "Oh, cool," said Sylvie, Pris, Azalin, and Bilana. The tiger, just a young one, apparently, but already trading the clumsy shape of a kitten for the sleekness of a full-grown cat, made a pleased little grumbling noise and batted at the side of Kate's face with one oversized orange forepaw. Its tail flicked nonchalantly back and forth, dangling down like an inverse periscope. Caitlin blinked at it as if she couldn't believe she was holding it, then looked in turn at Zoner and everybody he had named, with the exception of the absent Bernie Kaltingen, of course. "He's Monty's son," Erd explained, reaching to scruffle the tiger's ears. "Full Neo-Siberian, 6 months old. His name is Sergei, after Prokofiev. Bernie usually called him Serge."
"Serge," said Caitlin softly.
She shifted her hold on the striped creature, freeing a hand to very tentatively pet his head. He made that grumbling sound again and leaned closer, tail flagging contentedly. "Now that," said Nall approvingly, "is a cat."
"Don't listen to him, Peril," said Dorothy Wainwright, hugging her cat.
"What?" said Nall. "Peril's a good cat, too. He's just small."
"You're small, too," Wakaba pointed out.
"You just haven't seen me big," Nall replied smugly.
"Uh-huh," replied Wakaba, unconvinced.
"All the paperwork," Griffin began, then looked over the edge of the box and stopped. For no apparent reason, he adopted a bad German accent.
"Ist not in the box. Zoner!"
"Jawohl,"
said Zoner, stiffening to attention.
"You have the paperwork? You had better have the paperwork."
Zoner reached into an inside pocket, looking thoughtful, tried another, then another, and another, muttering as he did so,
"Was, if I can't find the paperwork, though I forge new paperwork, where is the problem?"
before at last producing a sheaf of papers out of the first pocket he'd tried. "Here we go," he said, reverting to his normal voice. "Breeding certificate, LSD affidavit of authenticity, Neocat behavior certification, Avalon County Department of Animal Control pet license, import authorization from the Bajoran government, Vedic Barile's letter of approval, President Tiefeld's same..." "Yep, this is everything."
"Why don't you hold on to these for the time being?" said Kay to Jury, and handed her the documents.
"Kate's hands are full," she added, grinning. Jury smiled, folded the papers double, and tucked them away. Caitlin seemed to return from a long way away, blinked again, and looked at the nearest person on the list, her mother.
"How?"
"Thank Mr. Strange Attractor there, mostly," said Kay, aiming a thumb at Zoner. "Back in June, through a strange quirk of fate, the Cotralin Brothers Circus ended up with an unexpected Neo-Tiger cub. They were looking for some other reputable circus or animal act to take him off their hands once initial training was complete.
and damned if Zoner didn't happen to surf by their website.
Just pure luck, Zoner insisted piously.
From there, said Kay, it was just a matter of convincing the circus that you weren't the average dumb citizen looking for a cool pet.
Erd smirked. I had a little to do with that.
Could have just given her a circus, but no, muttered Zoner with a mock put-upon air.
So did Bernie, said Griffin, grinning. He remembered you, Kate, and lobbied hard. He says Monty seemed to like the idea, too. I guess you made quite an impression.
It had taken Caitlin a little while to remember where she'd heard the name Bernie Cultingen before, but as soon as she'd seen what was inside the box, it came back to her in an instant. Once, when she was a little girl, Kate had met a Neo-Tiger, a Neo-Siberian by the name of Monty, when the Catrelan Brothers Circus came to New Avalon. Her mother, knowing her fondness for the cats, had arranged it with Monty's keeper, the very same Bernie, a cheerful Seleucian with a ready smile and a big, booming voice like Moose McEachern's. 4-year-old Kate had been enchanted, not only by Monty himself, but also by the obvious bond that existed between Monty and Bernie. From that day to this, she dreamed of having a companion like Monty. But Neo-Tigers were uncommon creatures, and well-tempered or not, they had to be handled with care and respect simply because of their size. They made a lot of people nervous, and they required a lot of space to be happy. They were also expensive to feed. Kate knew that if the day ever came, it would take a lot of luck and a lot of doing to arrange, and it would have to be after she got out of school and was out on her own somewhere. Somewhere roomy. But then, of course, she'd never expected that she'd be in a school on a nearly uninhabited forest moon, with a large castle for a dorm. Plenty of space there. Kate's arms were starting to get tired. Serge was pretty small for a tiger, but he still got heavy after a while. She carried him over to one of the couches and sat carefully down, arranging the young tiger in her lap. He sprawled out contentedly, not a care in the world, his tail hanging loosely over the front of the sofa. When Kate looked up again, her eyes were full of tears. Utina, with the ease and grace of long practice, reached over and eased off her glasses before her eyes could overflow and stain the lenses with salt. Normally, when she did that to Anthy back in the day, it was to prevent her from nodding off and squashing them into the bridge of her nose, but the technique worked just as well in cases like this. She shook her head, then smiled an enormous, teary smile and whispered,
thank you.
Say, said Utina, crouching down next to the couch and reaching over the arm to touch the Neo-Tiger's glossy back, is this guy going to grow up to be an honest-to-God Siberian tiger?
Yep, said Kay. Serge, noticing the contact, rolled over and started swiping playfully at Utina's hand.
Damn, said Utina, the impressed damn, not the upset kind, as she played a little impromptu game of patty cake with the tiger.
I guess Kate's going to have to reinforce her bed.
Kate snuffled explosively, a laugh colliding with a sob, and said,
I guess so.
Utina leaned over so the rest of the room wouldn't hear her and murmured,
You bet you will. Once he's full grown, add in jury, that'll be something like 700 pounds of snuggle.
That erased the crying from the equation. Caitlin laughed until new tears came, then wiped them away with her sleeve, accepted the replacement of her glasses by her roommate, and said to Serge,
Well, Serge, welcome to the family.
Hmm, said Serge, and he whacked her gently in the face with his tail.
Poor Seven's going to be so jealous, Azalin observed.
He'll just have to learn to share, said Kate gamely. Won't he, Serge?
But you'll make it easy for him, won't you?
Hmm,
said Serge, and batted the other side of her face with his tail.
I hate to be a wet blanket, said B'Elanna hesitantly, but isn't a tiger kind of a dangerous pet? I mean, he's all right now, and he's definitely prettier than a targ, but when he grows up... She shrugged. They're wild animals, after all. Oh no, it'll be fine, said Miki Kaworu cheerily. Serge is a neo-tiger. Which means... With the patient tone of a professor, Miki explained what it meant. In a nutshell, what it meant was that Serge was not a wild tiger. That would be both inhumane and really quite stupid. Rather, he was a Neo-Siberian, one of the 5 breeds of Neo-Tigers, engineered variants on the great cats which were created during the genetic revolution of the 22nd century, in order to improve the lot in life of the performing animals in circuses and the like. Originally, Miki explained, this process was developed for lions. The sad truth was that normal lions, being wild animals, they were, however cleverly tamed, always dangerous. As such, they always had to be treated like dangerous animals. They had to be caged when not performing, handled with great care and circumspection, sometimes treated roughly just to keep them from hurting someone, or themselves for that matter. They didn't seem to enjoy their lives much, which was the main thrust of animal rights activists' constant calls for the abandonment of the performing animals tradition. So some enterprising geneticist at the Wedge Defense Force Life Sciences Division, whose unofficial motto was, "You should because you can," came up with the idea of twiddling the genes of a normal lion to simulate the centuries of breeding and acculturation which had produced the domestic house cat from whatever wild creature had been its forebear, without the unfortunate side effects which had led the modern domestic cat to its gloomy fate of birth defects, congenital diseases, hip dysplasia, and whatnot. The result, the theory went, would be a gregarious, intelligent, fun-loving animal which enjoyed doing silly tricks for the pleasure of humans, and, since it wasn't a dangerous wild beast, only looked like one, it could be let free when not performing, kept in the lion keeper's home as a pet, like the dog show master's dancing dogs. Meanwhile, the wild lions go back to the wild, run, rut, eat gazelles, whatever makes them happy. No muss, no fuss, everybody wins. The process took 10 years to develop and cribbed fairly heavily from the earlier Military Utility Genetic Higher Intelligence Program, whose famous creation resembled a cross between a cat, a bear, and a particularly shaggy throw rug. The Moogie creature was certainly intelligent and personable, though, and those were exactly the traits that the Neo-Lion engineers were after. In the end, the prototype Neo-Lion, Samson, was perhaps a bit too smart. In addition to personability and the capacity to learn complex tricks, Samson displayed a profound capacity for mischief and a very well-developed sense of humor. But that was all to the good, and the engineers promptly labeled the whole project a rousing success, developed the tooling to translate it to several other popular species, and then sat back waiting for the accolades. Instead, they were highly bewildered when those same animal rights people got on their case for playing God and engineering a slave race. The LSD engineers involved with the project shook their heads, concluded that there was just no pleasing some people, and went on with their lives. Neo-Tigers went on to become the most popular and successful of the Neo-Cat line. Normal great cats went back to the wild, except for the ones in zoos. Purists. And aside from the anti-genetic engineering crowd, everybody was happy. That's why he's so playful, then, said Sylvie thoughtfully. His kind were engineered to be, Miki confirmed, nodding. Also highly intelligent. There's a good chance he understands some of what we're saying. Wow, Miki, said Sylvie, taking the blue-haired duelist's arm and leaning her head against his shoulder. You know so much stuff. Miki gave her a glance, not nervous as it once would have been, but sort of detachedly amused, and said dryly, I read a lot. I'll bet you do, Sylvie replied. Zoner considered admonishing his daughter, decided Kaworu could take care of himself, and stayed out of it. Kate was occupied for the next couple of hours.
Inside the box, she discovered several toys, including a large striped rubber ball of which Serge seemed inordinately fond. They were still playing when the mirror on the far wall glowed, and, to the utter amazement of Bilana Torres, out came Aunt Belle and her family. Several of the people here had not met Belle's husband, a pleasant-looking fellow named Keiichi, or their children, 14-year-old Hiroshi, 12-year-old Mirai, and the 5-year-old twins, and, of course, the little blonde form of Mary Broadbank, contemporary of Mirai, Sylvie, and the Morgan twins, who looked so much like her two elder sisters that those who knew Liza and Clarissa were a little startled by the common resemblance in the family. For a second, looking at Corwin's youngest cousins, Wakaba Shinohara had decided that they were a pair of little twin boys. Then she revised her estimate and decided they were girls. Then Belle introduced them as Makoto and Fatora, and she realized that there was one of each. But they looked so much alike it was eerie. "Gosh," she whispered to Miki Kaworu, "they look more alike than you and Kozue. It's scary." Miki nodded. If it weren't impossible, I'd say they were identical. "We are identical," said Fatora, identifiable only by her longer hair, in a didactic tone of voice. Miki blinked, then crouched down to have his eyes on a level with her. "But you can't be," he said, not in the tone of a grown-up correcting a child's misconception, but as one adult to another seeking clarification on a confusing point of data. "Identical twins come from a single zygote. They're genetically identical." "We were," Fatora said. Then she nudged her brother with an elbow and said, "Until Genius Boy here mutated himself a Y chromosome." Makoto rolled his eyes. "Fatora, we don't know that's what happened." "Well, what else could have happened?" said Fatora. "You explain why we're genetically identical except for that one factor." "I can't," Makoto replied in a patient, "I've had this conversation way too many times already," tone of voice. "That's why it's called a freak occurrence." "You guys are 5, said Wakaba. "That's right," said Fatora. "Almost 6, Makoto added. Fatora snorted. "Our birthday's in May, Mr. Wizard." "Sometimes," Makoto replied, "I feel like I've been stuck with you for 60 years. "You just complain because I'm smarter," Fatora replied haughtily. "In your dreams," Makoto muttered. "Don't fight on Christmas, dears," said Beltandy. "Yes, mother," replied both twins in dutiful stereo. "Man," said Wakaba once the twins had been led away out of earshot. "Creepy." Miki watched them with a pensive look for a few more moments, then blinked, checked his watch, and said, "Sorry, Wakaba?" Wakaba smiled and patted him on the shoulder. "Nothing. Sorry. I shouldn't have brought Kozue up." "No, it's okay," said Miki, shaking his head. "I just hope she's not too miserable today." "Kozue's never liked Christmas," he explained. "Backlash against our parents mistaking money for love philosophy. She used to call it bribery day. But it was the one day out of the year, even when she resented me, that she'd call a truce and let herself act like she loved me." "She does love you," Wakaba told him. "That was the problem. Look, I know this is kind of a sad thing, but maybe you'll be able to see the good in it. She missed you an awful lot after you disappeared, but she didn't get frantic or go into a funk or turn bitchy again. She just sort of took over for you. She told me once that she was determined to do things so that when you returned, you'd be proud of her." Miki gazed at her for a moment with a grateful look on his face, then said, "Thank you. You've never told me that before." Wakaba grinned awkwardly. "It's, never really come up before," she reminded him. "True," he conceded with a smile. "Well, with any luck," he added, glancing across the room to where Utena was meeting the twins,
and from the look on her face, she was receiving an uncomfortable grilling from Fatora, probably about something to do with Corwin, who was nearby turning red. I'll get the chance to be proud before too much longer. If I could figure out how to send you back, I would, Wakaba told him. Hell, I'd send us all back. We could all form a huge, complicated murder plot to bump off Otori. You know, like in Murder on the Orient Express. Miki, who had taken the same literature course the previous D-term, did indeed know. He chuckled and said, I think Uchna might have an objection to that plan. Yeah, well, I only hope that when she does go back, someone can convince her to just use a shotgun and get it the hell over with. What is it Caitlin says? Honorable battle is for honorable foes? Asked Sionji. Yeah, that's it. How long have you been standing there? I heard the name Otori. I got curious. Oh.